It was sinfully treacherous. But as Morgan Scanwell inevitably abandoned his moral rectitude and succumbed at last to the woman who sought to touch his power, Jane came at last to Dan Randolph's bed. To their mutual surprise, she discovered that she had fallen in love with this scoundrel, her husband's best friend. By the time Scanwell was campaigning for the presidency, Jane had painfully terminated her affair with Dan. She had the strength to end it. The White House was more important to her than romance. "The country needs Morgan, Dan," she said, convincing herself by trying to convince him. "And he needs me. We can't jeopardize his chances by sneaking around behind his back. If anyone found out, he'd be finished." Morgan Scanwell was governor of Texas then. Dan's personal fortune was nearing $1 billion. He knew that Jane's mind was made up, so he went back to his old ways and became notorious again for his sexual pursuits. While he was squandering his energies on every woman he desired, Jane allowed a compliant Oklahoma legislature to confer a residency upon her so she could run for vice president alongside her husband. Morgan was elected president, only to face a string of crises that killed him. The Russian Federation emerged from its own desperate internal cataclysms with a new belligerency. After coming so perilously close to dissolution and civil war that the rest of the world expected the tottering new federation to collapse, the Russians regained control of their sprawling land and peoples. The United States, half disarmed, was suddenly confronted with a resurgent, bellicose Moscow. America had long since lost real interest in space and had allowed Japan and Europe to take the leadership in space developments. Now the Russians, with the world's most powerful rockets and still armed with thousands of ballistic missiles, quickly took a stranglehold on all space operations, military as well as civilian. The U.S. economy was foundering. The Russians were making demands on an unprepared America. Congress studied opinion polls that showed the American people were in no mood for a war that would rain hydrogen bombs on their heads. America bowed, and Morgan Scanwell suffered a fatal stroke. Dan Randolph left Texas when Congress revoked all federal licenses for space operations. Astro Manufacturing moved to Venezuela, and Jane Scanwell became the first woman president of the United States. She still held a deep passion for Dan Randolph, but now that passion had turned to hatred. 3. The Global Economic Council's Lunar Tribunal was based in Copernicus City. Like all the other centers on the moon, Copernicus was deep underground, gouged out of lunar rock to protect its human population from the lethal radiation and enormous temperature swings up on the airless surface. Ostensibly, the GEC was politically neutral. It insisted that all lunar habitats be given geographic names rather than being named after national biases. Thus, the Russian penal colony was officially titled Aristarchus Center, even though most lunar residents still called it by its older name, Lunagrad. On all GEC maps, the great Japanese manufacturing center was called Alphonsus City rather than Yamagata Industries Lunar Operation No. 1. The place where humans had first set foot on the moon's dusty surface was still called Tranquility Base. The American astronauts had even then been thinking in non-nationalistic terms. The Lunar Tribunal had all the aspects of a court of law. There was a bank with high-backed seats for three judges, although officially they were titled conciliators. But as Dan Randolph took his seat among the rows of benches for onlookers, he thought that the conciliators never really reconciled grievances. All he had ever seen them do was take a man's hard-earned wealth and hand it over to the GEC. He looked with mixed emotions at the sky-blue flag of the United Nations standing to one side of the bank. He knew the world could not afford the divisive competition of nationalism, especially when even the smallest nation could manufacture biological weapons that could slaughter millions. But the alternative was a global government to which there was no appeal, a worldwide bureaucracy that was gradually imposing a dictatorship by committee, leveling everything on Earth to the same flat gray dullness. And now they were extending their grip to the moon. There was no jury box in this courtroom. The three conciliators listened to the evidence and made their decision. There was no appeal, either. Mitchell and his zombie of a lawyer entered the tribunal chamber from the side door. The robot recording machine said, "All rise," and the three conciliators trooped in from the door behind the bunk. They wore ordinary business clothes rather than robes. Two men and one woman, the chief of the team. Dan glanced at his own lawyer sitting beside him. Catherine Williams was a pert, young, ambitious redhead who had swiftly risen to the top of his legal department, despite fierce competition. She knew all the tales about Dan Randolph's skirt chasing. When Dan had first interviewed her for a job, she had firmly announced that she did not sleep with the boss. Not yet, Dan had thought, eyeing her with approval. Now, several years later, she was his top lawyer, and he wondered what her body looked like underneath the tailored royal blue jacket and fitted gold slacks she was wearing.
"The tribunal is ready to pass sentence," said the woman occupying the middle chair up on the bank. Her voice was sharp, cutting. "Does the defendant have anything to say in his own behalf?"
Mitchell's lawyer got to his feet, a tall scarecrow dressed like a funeral director. With a voice to match, he intoned sorrowfully, "The defendant deeply regrets the actions which have led to this proceeding, Your Honors. He regrets his actions so deeply, in fact, that he has divested himself of all ownership in the company that he has founded and directed, Mitchell Mining and Smelting. His remorse has led him to repudiate the ownership of his own company. This is similar to renouncing parenthood of one's own child. It is a deeply wrenching, emotional..."
"Counselor," snapped the chief conciliator, "are you telling us that Mr. Mitchell has sold off his company?"
"Yes, Your Honor. And I respectfully request that this act of true remorse and regret be considered punishment enough for his mistaken actions of the past." The woman snorted disdainfully and glanced at her two male colleagues.
"To whom has he sold his company?" she asked.
"To Astro Manufacturing Incorporated, Your Honor."
"I see. Is there a representative of Astro Manufacturing in this chamber?"
Dan got to his feet. "I represent Astro, Your Honor. My name is Daniel Hamilton Randolph." All three judges smiled at Dan the way Torquemada might have smiled at a rabbi. Dan smiled back and said, "Your Honors, Astro is quite willing to pay the penalty that you have already decided to assess against Mitchell Mining and Smelting." Dan knew that the penalty was already recorded in their computer file of this proceeding. If they changed it now, because Astro could afford an astronomically larger fine, or because they hated Dan Randolph's guts, it would give Astro's lawyers a perfect excuse to claim prejudice and demand a new trial. The three judges put their heads together and conferred briefly, hands over the tiny microphones embedded in the desktop before them. Finally, the chief conciliator, her face grim, leveled a hard stare at Dan.
"Mr. Randolph, this tribunal cannot help but believe that your acquisition of Mitchell Mining and Smelting is nothing less than an obvious ploy to thwart justice."
Dan put on an expression of injured innocence. "But, Your Honor, the truth is exactly the opposite. I'm sure that the fine you've assessed against Mitchell would bankrupt his company and drive him out of business. His assets would become the property of the Global Economic Council. The GEC would have to assume the burden of running the mining and smelting operation.
GEC management would see that the operation remained within its allotted quotas," the chief conciliator snapped angrily. "There would be no attempts to illegally increase profits by dumping excess ores on the world market and driving prices down from their mandated levels."
Dan's smile turned slightly impish. "Yes, we all know GEC operations never show any profits. Somehow, when the GEC takes over a company, it always seems to run at a loss." His lawyer made a polite little cough, a warning to get off that tack. "This is no time for sticking the needle into them," she was telling Dan. Still facing the judges, Dan went on. "However, Astro Manufacturing is quite willing to pay the fine you've assessed, and Astro will manage Mitchell Mining and Smelting at a profit, I'm sure, while staying within the GEC's mandated quotas. That will generate more tax revenues for the GEC. Everybody gains. It's a win-win situation.
And what of Mr. Mitchell? The chief conciliator